The Tom Woods Show, episode 2262.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce: The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to be joined once again by our old friend, Germinal G. Van. And I know you're thinking to yourself, Woods, it is not possible that this guy has another volume out. And I'm going to tell you, you're right. He doesn't have another volume out. He has another two volumes out. He has a two-volume series that we're going to start talking about in this episode, but we're going to return to it, to be perfectly honest with you, once I finish plowing through it, because there's so much here. It is called A History of Wealth Distribution in the United States from Colonial Times to the Modern Era, 1760 to 2019. Volume one is 1760 to 1929. We're going to start there today. Germinal is the author of, all right, go ahead, tell me, how many is it now?
Well, I was about to say 25, but it is 26. 26 books because of this book divided into two volumes.
Two volumes, okay.
So yeah, 26 books.
All right.
Okay. 26 in one.
All right. Well, again, I think you need to come on and do like a time management seminar or something for my people, because I don't know how this is possible. But, you know, I always joke, I was 47 when I got the Hayek Lifetime Achievement Award. And I thought, that's pretty good. I'm not even 50. And I got a Lifetime Achievement Award. You're going to get like three of these, man. You know, it's going to be great. All right. Anyway, let's jump in and dig right in into this here. I want to start with a few general things. Now, distribution is a funny word, because if people read it the wrong way, they can get the wrong idea. I personally don't like the word distribution in this context, because it feeds into the Bernie Sanders idea that there's a big pile and somebody is handing out portions of the pile, and the result is wealth distribution. Mm-hmm. Whereas the market economy has no distribution mechanism at all. It's just a series of buying and selling decisions and wage payments and stuff like that. There's no distribution going on. But what you mean by the term is how wealth is, let's say, again, I always feel like it's hard to avoid using the word distributed among people in society. But without implying that there is a distributor mm-hmm. who's going around saying, okay, you're entitled to this, you're entitled to that. Because there are some Bernie people who kind of feel like wealthy people are generally shysters and they grabbed a big chunk of the pie mm-hmm. and that leaves a smaller chunk for everybody else. And I just don't want to feed into that.
Mm. So I'm going to help you out here. I mean, the word that we could use to not use distribution is allocation.
Allocation is also possible. That's somewhat better.
Right. So how wealth is allocated. And the best way to understand the allocation of wealth is to simply see how a company allocates its wealth. So you have usually land, capital, and labor, right? So land now is not necessarily included in the production function, but we're going to work with capital and labor. When income flows in the company, it depends. If the company has done really well, of course, the company will have more income. And when the company has more income, the first thing that the owner does is to allocate a portion into the capital, because you need capital to get more machine, more labor, etc. And now the other portion is allocated to the labor function. And since there is enough income that came into the company, so the owner can hire more people or increase the wages of those who already work for him, and he can even promote people. But when the company is going through hard times, the owner will still allocate the portion of that income into capital. And now what is going to happen is that the labor function is the one that is going to fluctuate. So during hardships, the owner will have to decrease is labor function, meaning that you have to fire people or you have to reduce wages and etc. And that's the point that people ignore sometimes when we talk about wealth distribution. They think that, oh yeah, the worker is the one putting all the pieces together, therefore he deserves to have a better salary and everything. I understand the part about having better working conditions. That's true. But when it comes to allocating the income generated by the company, it is important to understand that the owner will always prioritize capital first because he's investing in capital that provides more income for the company. So that's how wealth is basically distributed. You simply look at how a company allocates its income based on what they generate. And it's the same thing that you do for society at large.
Let's talk about also the other point that we see early on, like that you lay out as you're describing the way you look at the world. And that is the issue of inequality. Because obviously, when you talk about different people, different groups of people having different amounts of wealth, the subject of inequality comes up. And you take a pretty difficult to misinterpret stand on the subject of inequality and whether there's a moral dimension to it or not, and what we should think about the subject of wealth inequality. So why don't you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, so the real issue with wealth and income inequality is the moral dimension. Because if you take the moral dimension away from the question, inequality is the norm. Because in order to create wealth, someone has to take risks. Someone has to take money, whether from his own pocket or raising capital from investors, and put that money to work, filing for the legal entity, setting up the bank account, buying the machines and everything that goes along with it. And the worst part is that there is no guarantee that the creation of this structure, which is technically an investment, there's no guarantee that that investment will work because investments are by nature speculative. And all the investors that put their money with the owner of the company, they're all at risk too. If the company is doing well, everyone benefits from it. If the company doesn't do well, the owner and the investors will be losing a lot of money. So that's why when the company is working, is doing well, the owners and the investors become super wealthy, right? They become super wealthy because they took that risk that the worker did not take. And without the owner and the investors taking that risk, there will be no work in the first place. Because someone has to create that legal structure, that legal entity, in order to hire people and et cetera. And when you look at now, as I talk about the distribution initially, the owner is going to work on the labor function based on how much the company has generated. That is why owners in wherever country you look at, people who own businesses are always the wealthiest. Because they are producers, they are the suppliers, they're the one who provide a service or a product to the population at large. And because people like the product or service being supplied to them, they keep buying. As they keep buying, the supplier enriches himself. And the issue is that when people see income and wealth inequality, they see it as a zero-sum game. They believe that this guy became rich because he had to impoverish someone else. It's not true. There is no mechanism saying that in order for one to become rich, the other has to be impoverished. That's not true. One can become rich and the other person can become rich as well. And what Marx and Piketty successfully did was to enlarge the moral dimension of wealth inequality, making it a moral issue. And I think we talked about that in one of your previous episodes. We're saying that if you ask the average person why wealth should be distributed equally, that person will never give you an economic rationale. That person will only give you a moral rationale as to why they should do. But economics is not about morality. It's about facts. It's about self-interest. It's about people doing what is best for them. And Adam Smith explained that when people pursue their self-interest, they indirectly contribute to society's betterment. So that is the real problem with inequality, is to see it as a zero-sum game rather than seeing it as a natural, normal phenomenon of life, because poverty is the norm. When the earth was created, there was no buildings around. There was no wealth creation. Human beings, so everyone started at zero. Everyone started poor. It's people's attitude toward assets, people's attitude toward money that made the difference between those who have more money and those who remain poor. But I believe that everyone started at the bottom line initially, which was poverty.
I saw a graphic on Facebook the other day in which somebody says, I may not know much, but I know that workers make everything. And I just thought, what a cartoonish way, and how appropriate it was in the form of a cartoon. Cartoonish way of understanding the role that various people play in the production process. The point is, look, my father was a worker. So it's not like I am just predisposed to be hostile to workers. I'm not hostile to them. But my father drove a forklift. That doesn't mean he was qualified to be CEO. Mm-hmm. And of course, he didn't do the saving necessary to invest in all the equipment or mm-hmm. make the day-to-day decisions or any of this. And not to mention, like, for example, when you look at what's going on at Southwest Airlines right now,
yep.
I would much, much rather be a guy sweeping the floors at Southwest Airlines than be the CEO at this
right.
moment. You know? Because it's not my problem. You know, I'm going to get my paycheck
exactly.
one way or the other. So anyway, that's another matter.
And I even forgot to add that when the owner of the company, right, does the allocation of income, and the labor function is the one that has to shift based on how much has been made by the company, right? At the end of the day, the labor function gets paid because there is a contract that is enforced by the court. So all the workers, no matter how the company is doing, they're still getting their paycheck, because if they don't get paid, they can sue the owner for failure to pay them. So the owner, at the end of the day, gets nothing, because the owner gets common stocks, especially if the owner had to raise capital in order to get the company going. So the first payment that he does was, of course, to his workers and to his investors too. So his investor gets preferred shares. So they have to get paid before he gets paid. And on top of that, he has to save for the taxes, because taxes have to be paid quarterly. You see, these are all factors that workers don't take into consideration, and people who defend the workers and everything don't take into consideration. The owner of a company literally gets nothing for quite a while. It's only when the company becomes profitable that the owner starts to breathe a little bit. But for the first 3 to 5 years, whatever profit that is made, the owner cannot even take that money for himself. He has to reinvest in the company in order to get the engine going and making it profitable. So this is a very important factor to emphasize.
These are two very large volumes, and the purpose of them is not simply to list a bunch of statistics. There's a thesis you want to defend in here. Mm-hmm. So in surveying all this material, what is your thesis? What is your argument that's underlying this whole presentation?
My argument is very simple. Wealth inequality is not that it's a good thing, it's a necessary thing, because life is not equal. Because those who take the risk deserve the reward of their risk. And the United States is one of the most unequal countries on earth. Absolutely. But it is a country that is surely unequal on a social aspect. But this inequality is not based on the growth of the political class squandering the wealth that has been created by the entire nation. On the contrary, compared to, you know, like third countries, like let's say a country like Central African Republic, where you see the political elite being extremely wealthy and the rest of the population is super poor, like the same in Soviet Russia. But in the United States, the wealthiest people are the people in the private sector, because they're the one taking the risk. They're the one putting the economy to work. And they're the one creating disruptive companies that basically change humanity and improve the living standard of people. So the point is to say in this book that in order for the standard of living of a society to improve, it has to rely on inequality. Because if everyone is equal, there can be no improvement. Because improvement suggests that a group of people have to move from one income bracket to another. But if everyone is equal, therefore there's no mobility. That's the point of mobility. For you to move from $40,000 a year to $80,000 a year, someone else who was in that bracket has to move from $80,000 to, I don't know, $100,000 or $120,000. So it has to be unequal. And on top of that, people with more experience in the workforce get a higher salary than someone who just got an entry-level job. Here too, this is a clear sign of inequality. Why you, who's just started a job, an entry-level position, will want to have the salary of someone who has been 15 years at the company? It doesn't make sense. So inequality is important. Of course, too much inequality is also not good, because it creates resentment. And that's where people like Bernie Sanders and many populist leaders in third world country were able to capitalize on. They use populism, they use the resentment of the poor toward the rich to tap on their fear and saying, look, this guy is the one exploiting you. This guy is the one doing this and doing that. That is why you cannot thrive financially. And that's what Marx did. And that's what Thomas Piketty did also in his two voluminous books. And I mean, you can tell that when I started the preface, I did not go easy on him.
No, you did not. I did make note of that. But the other kind of implicit thesis of the book has to do with the way government policy affects the distribution.
Absolutely.
Because it's all over the book.
Yep.
All different ways that government policy channels wealth in particular directions. And so why don't we jump into the colonial period on the eve of the revolution? Because you start the book in 1760 and you start it with a discussion of mercantilism. And then you go through some of the mercantile policies imposed on the colonies. Mm-hmm. And of course, these have their effects, don't they? So first of all, what's the thinking behind mercantilism? And then secondly, what are examples of this? And what are the effects on the way wealth is, if we may say, allocated?
Okay, that's actually a great question, Tom. So mercantilism is an economic system in which it is believed that the wealth of a nation is based on raw materials and amount of gold and other precious metals. This is one of the reasons why we have colonization. People did not colonize just for the sake of colonizing. Sure, it's true that back in the days, people also had a more barbaric attitude in general. So going to war was a matter of pride. But it was not the ultimate and the primary decision of going to war. People went to war in order to increase the wealth of their society, because they're like, okay, we believe that there are finite resources, which is true, and the area in which we live, those resources aren't enough. So the issue of scarcity already start playing an important role. So technically, I can say that mercantilism is kind of like the birth of economics, because it emphasized the role of scarcity. But now the question was, how are we going to increase the wealth of our nation so that we can improve the lives of the people who live in the country? The only way to do that is to go colonize people, is to go take another territory. And when you colonize, you don't come and knock on someone's door, hey, can I take your resources, man? No, you brutally subjugated them. And that's what has happened in Africa. That's what has happened in North America, South America, basically all around the world. But the problem with mercantilism is that there was no socioeconomic mobility. What I mean by that is, since the wealth of a nation is believed to be based on the amount of raw materials, the amount of gold and other precious metal, for someone to be moving from one income bracket to another, it has to be done by law. And that is what many countries in Europe at the time, specifically England, did. So it wasn't the amount of goods and services that people create in society that creates wealth in general. No, it wasn't like that. It's the amount of gold that you are able to extract, or the amount of raw materials that you're able to extract from that country you colonized, that will be able to increase the wealth in your motherland. And that is what England did with Canada and the United States. So in the US, like, they implemented the Sugar Act, the Currency Act, so all these tax laws to create revenues for the state. And Americans start to have enough of it. They're like, okay, like, we are the one here actually doing the work, and those guys, they keep taxing us on all the work we're producing already. This is not fair. So there was that aspect. And then the political aspect was also self-determination, because the US was formed in a very decentralized fashion. You have people living in New England, you have people living in Virginia, in the Carolinas, and everyone had their cultures. Even they had different currencies. It was extremely decentralized. So they realized that they were completely different from the UK, where government was centralized through the king and parliament. True, parliament tried to reduce the powers of the king, but power remained centralized at the end of the day compared to the United States. So the US wanted to detach itself completely from the UK by creating a society that would be decentralized, where we would place the individual above the group. We would place the welfare and the well-being of the individual above the national interest, if I can put it that way. And what is interesting was the coincidence between the independence, the Declaration of Independence, and the publication of the Wealth of Nations. Because the Wealth of Nations played a tremendous role, especially it gave the economic vision of the Founding Fathers to the Constitution. And I wrote that in chapter 2 of the book. The Founding Fathers wrote the U.S. Constitution with a very specific economic intent. They already believed that it's not the role of the government to distribute wealth according to whatever. The only person who kind of believed that was Alexander Hamilton. But even his belief in distributing the wealth equitably or equally was not because he had a great heart. For him, it was just a mechanism to give more leeway, more power, more involvement of the government into economic affairs. So to come back to mercantilism, the way to ascend in society was made by decree rather than by the laws of supply and demand. And that's why, like, unless you're close to political power, unless you're a friend with the king or whoever was in charge at the time, unless you're a friend with that person, unless you're close to that person, you cannot become wealthy in a system based on mercantilism.
So that is how we assess the issue of, again, wealth distribution in the age of mercantilism, is that we have to look at people's connections to the state, and that's obviously going to play a significant role in determining, you know, who, and it's not definitive. You could become wealthy without these advantages, but a lot of people are going to take advantage of the advantages.
Absolutely.
And that's how it winds up. But now, if we can go a little bit faster here and just move into the period of the early republic, the federal government is much, much less involved in the day-to-day lives, obviously, of the American public than it is today. So I was actually wondering, as I read it, what policies is he going to be looking at that might have some effect on the way wealth is moved around in society? And so in the first couple of decades, what would be some of the somewhat modest policies of the federal government that would have an effect on that?
Yeah, so at the time of the early republic, wealth was essentially based on the ownership of land, because the U.S. was an agricultural society until the 1820s, when the revolution, the Industrial Revolution, finally came into the U.S. Primary to that, the U.S. was an agricultural society. So owning land was the way to build wealth and to become extremely wealthy. And I explain, I even show a graph of the U.S. presidents, how all these presidents from George Washington to John Quincy Adams, how all these guys were wealthy. That's why I call it the aristocratic republic. And they even created a political system in which only the wealthy could vote. Personally, I like that system because it emphasized the importance of responsibility compared to the system we have today, which is a democratic system where everyone could vote. People don't even understand what policies are at stake, but they still vote. Back then, in order for you to vote, you need to have something at stake. It's like taking a loan at the bank and the bank is asking you for collateral. What are you going to put as collateral for you to get the loan? So you will think twice before going to the bank and take a loan. So it was the same in the aristocratic republic. So since everything was based on land, the landowners were able to establish a mechanism with farmers who were generally tenants. They say, like, if you were able, right, if you use my land for X amount of time, maybe I can sell it to you by then. And on top of that, the government implement laws that would facilitate the purchase of land. So that was one big policy that changed the distribution of wealth. So basically what the government did at the time was to facilitate access to land purchases. And One way in which that worked was with the Louisiana Purchase. And that's actually how it made it easier for middle-class Americans, so farmers who were tenants, to start purchasing land in the United States. Because the United States at the time, the 13 colonies, it was quite small. And Thomas Jefferson was the very first American president to engage into a policy of expansion. So it kind of looked like mercantilism here, but here it wasn't because wealth was based on raw materials, because wealth was based on land. The 13 colonies becoming too concentrated, the population is growing, so we have to move people away. We have to move people westward so that there is more land available, so people can use that land, put it to work, and start creating agricultural output and wealth with that.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. What are the implications for the distribution of wealth of the dispute between Hamilton and Jefferson? Because they disagreed constitutionally and economically on a number of important things. Depending on how that came out, because history doesn't have to have gone the way it did, that could have come out differently. What would have been the consequences, you know, if one side had been completely victorious or the other side? What's it hanging in the balance on that with regard to wealth distribution?
Well, the thing with Hamilton and Jefferson was that even the approach to wealth distribution was based on the Constitution. It was like, should the federal government have power to be in charge of wealth distribution in the country? Based on how the Constitution was drafted, we can say that Jefferson won that debate because the Constitution was written with very specific limited powers. But I mean, with now the Supreme Court, we have more activist judges than true judges. The federal government became over time way more involved in how wealth should be distributed. Alexander Hamilton focused on the preamble of the Constitution, which focused on it is the role of the government to take care of the general welfare, etc. So it is a really vague phrase. But Hamilton literally built his entire philosophical and economic apparatus on this very phrase, like it is the role of the government to supervise or to oversee the general welfare of the citizens. And Jefferson did not believe in that. Jefferson believed that it is the role of the government to step away or to make laws that will facilitate access to land, because he believed in the human farmer. Like, the more access people have to land, the more independent they become, because he believed that freedom was in the acquisition of land, specifically acquisition of property. To him, owning land is owning property, and owning property is being free, because when you're free, you can do whatever you want. But if you don't own anything, it's going to become very difficult for you to be free. You have to always exchange your time for labor in order to make ends meet. So Jefferson was advocating for land ownership aggressively throughout his political career. And Hamilton wanted the federal government to not just focus on land, but to focus on the transformation of products. He believed in manufacturing, because in manufacturing, you don't focus on land anymore. You focus on machinery, equipment, and all of that. And he believed that it was the role of the government to invest in machinery in order to make the United States a modern society. And in doing that, the government now will have more power to decide and allocate resources based on how it sees fit. So in the aristocratic republic, the Jeffersonian vision prevailed because it was based on land. Many land acts policies were passed in order to facilitate access to land. And wealth, of course, was not distributed equally at the time. The proof is that even based on how the political framework was structured, only those who owned land had the privilege to vote. So I guess that was like an incentive to make Americans more involved in ownership. Because if you can own land, you have the right to vote and shape policies. So that was an incentive. But of course, it's an incentive that Andrew Jackson completely dismantled once he came to power.
There's so much we can talk about because you're covering basically everything. So I want to try to keep the discussion finite. Let me pick one more thing because you just mentioned Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. Let's say a little something about him. I'm going to get you back on. We'll move into the, let's say, some of the periods of American economic history that people consider even juicier than these. But for here, the thing I would say Andrew Jackson is best known for in terms of economics would be the fight against the bank.
Yes.
And now, he also had an overall philosophy, mm-hmm. which his followers, the Jacksonians, called, just referred to as equal rights. And when he used the phrase equal rights, he didn't mean it in the way it's often used today. By equal rights, he meant that the government would not arbitrarily hand out special privileges to any particular group because that would violate equal rights. Uh-huh. So what he meant by equal rights was very much a kind of a negative rights, that everybody is equally entitled not to get anything, any special privilege from the government. And that's how we help the working man, is we don't artificially hand out advantages to other people. Mm-hmm. That was equal rights.
Yep.
And no doubt there's an element of that philosophy present in the way Jackson looks at the bank question. So how do we assess, and I know you're coming at this from a Chicago point of view, mm-hmm. but of course, as you know, and you point out in the book a number of times, that a good many of the founding fathers were generally hard money people. Mm-hmm. And even if they weren't, they were still harder money than most people today. Even the ones who weren't 100% hard money were still harder money than today. So it was very mainstream in monetary thought to favor a hard money system, that is to say, precious metal coin-based system.
Yeah.
So what is the effect, again, on how wealth is spread in the U.S. of the monetary system, and maybe in particular, this question of the Second Bank of the U.S. under Andrew Jackson?
Yeah, so basically, as you say, like Andrew Jackson had a very economic and philosophical approach against the Bank of the United States, the National Bank of the United States. And this is because he saw the National Bank as a tool to select winners and losers, because it's basically like the central bank today, the Federal Reserve today. If the bank has that power, which gives the federal government then the power to select who is entitled to what, then is going to leave the working man in a difficult position to grow financially. And Andrew Jackson believed that in order for the working man to grow financially in a safe monetary system, the monetary system must be decentralized. And that's where we came down to the suffix system as well. And I even wrote like an entire chapter on free banking and central banking. But Andrew Jackson did not believe that we should have technically a central bank, because the National Bank to him was a central bank. That, sure, it did not decide necessarily on monetary policy the way the Federal Reserve does, but their policies were very close to the Federal Reserve. And that would have make it difficult for the average man to actually grow its wealth the way he believed that the working man deserved to grow its wealth. Because only the wealthy had access to hard money. The working man did not have access to hard money like that. And if the wealthy have access to hard money, they're not going to redistribute that hard money across society. And on top of that, there was also a political motivation. The political motivation was to maintain his political base, which is the working man. Because Andrew Jackson, he showed himself, he presented himself to the American people as a populist leader, someone who comes from the common folks, which is technically true. Like, he did not grow up in material opulence. He had to work hard to be where he was. So it was a difficult life for him. And he took advantage, of course, of that fact to build his entire political career. So for him, fighting against the National Bank was a way for him to show that he stands with the people. And on top of that, he believed that the National Bank was a tool to create too much debt because they had to pay like foreign, like basically European creditors for various investments into the U.S. manufacturing sector. And doing that, he believed that it was going to create too much debt for the country. And you can see in the book that Andrew Jackson is the only U.S. president who literally brought the national debt to zero. No U.S. president has done that. He brought the national debt to literally zero. So that's why, like, Andrew Jackson, he was one of the most beloved presidents, despite he was a ruthless man. He had a temper and everything. But that's why many Americans, specifically the middle class, saw in him a hero, because he stood for them. And on top of that, he's the one who granted all white male the right to vote. Because in the aristocratic republic, it was difficult for people to vote. Now, like, they say, hey, so long as you're 21 years old and you're white male, you can vote. So many white male over 21 years old were able to vote. And they were able to vote on policies that would eventually facilitate access to property and access to wealth. And that is why, for example, he applied the Indian Removal Act. It was to pursue the Jeffersonian westward expansion that he called Manifest Destiny.
One last thing. How does the absence of a national debt, even indirectly, help the average person?
Because if there is no national debt, that debt doesn't have to be passed on the next generations. Because today, if you look, like, the U.S. is a country that is built on credit. We borrow, we borrow, we borrow, and we don't pay. And the fact that we cannot pay, we basically defer that to the next generation, to our children, our grandchildren, and etc. And the more debt we accumulate, the more it becomes very difficult for the average person to build wealth, because most people don't have the money they need to start building wealth. Like, you have to take money as a loan. And if the loans start to pile up, it's going to be difficult. So you will be literally be paying debt all your life. So you have nothing for yourself and to live for your children. So that is what Andrew Jackson did not want. He wanted Americans to be debt free, so that the money you get is actually your money rather than the money of the bank that you have to repay somehow.
Okay. And so, unlike Hamilton, who had his own reasons for thinking that the national debt actually had benefits, Jackson just wouldn't have any of that. And isn't it interesting that Hamilton's philosophy was very expressly elitist?
Oh, absolutely.
And Jackson's was very expressly populist, and they have completely opposing views of the debt question. Not a coincidence.
No, not at all. And on top of that, if you look at the question of the debt, John Maynard Keynes built his economic philosophy on Hamilton's philosophy. The debt, like, how can you use the debt to increase national output? Right? Because that's what Hamilton said. Hamilton was, he believed that, oh, we can use the debt to invest in infrastructures. Like, yeah, let the U.S. keep borrowing money and borrowing money. And we're going to use that money borrowed to invest into infrastructures. It was this very same approach that John Maynard Keynes developed in his book, The General Theory. And that is the very same approach that FDR used during the Great Depression to get the country out of the Great Depression. It's using debt by basically accumulating the debt to try to take the country out of a depression. But I don't think that is the right approach. I don't think it is the right approach to impoverishing yourself by getting yourself out of poverty. Because taking debt means that you're impoverishing yourself. You're not making yourself richer.
So would you say that in general, now, I guess it can't be a general rule, because some government action can undo previous unwise government action. But by and large, what would you say, having surveyed basically 2.5 centuries worth of U.S. economic history, What conclusions can you draw about wealth and who owns what and government policy? Is there a general rule we can draw about the connection between these things?
There is a connection, but I wouldn't say there is like a rule per se. The connection is that at the end of the day, the government is the one that either facilitates or renders difficult access to ownership. And through the economic history of the United States, as the government became gradually involved in economic affairs, it has become difficult for people to actually build wealth because the government, as it became more involved, had now the capacity through the Federal Reserve to select winners and losers. And I know we're not discussing the second volume today, but in the second volume, that's where it focuses more on how government became so involved. And when you look at today, the use of quantitative easing actually increased income inequality. Because since quantitative easing is all about buying assets in exchange for converting those assets into cash to have more liquidity in the market, people then who profit from quantitative easing are the rich, not the poor, because the rich, they have a sophisticated knowledge of investment. So they have securities in the stock market, in the real estate market, or other type of security market. So when the central bank applies quantitative easing, they benefit from it compared to the middle class person who maybe doesn't have money in any asset-backed securities or asset-backed markets. So that's what the government and specifically the Federal Reserve began doing, is that their involvement made it much, much, much harder for the middle class and the poor to actually build wealth. Because today in America, to build wealth, you have to borrow money. You have to borrow from the bank. And the bank and the central bank is the one deciding on the level of interest rates. And as we know, like when interest rates are lower, they expand credit. And this expansion of credit now starts building financial bubbles. And as the financial bubble keeps increasing, eventually it bursts. And we have a recession or a depression. Even when we look at the Great Depression, when I argue the 3 points of the Great Depression, Chicago and Austrians both agreed that the Federal Reserve triggered the depression. But of course, they agreed for different reasons on why the Federal Reserve triggered the depression. But they both acknowledged that the Federal Reserve is the problem. And the Federal Reserve is not independent. It is the fourth branch of government, in my opinion. They just don't say it, but it is the fourth branch of government, the one that controls the supply of money and decides on the level of interest rates and credit. And this is on what people rely, like people need credit to buy a house. Because in America, it is widely believed that, which is actually not wrong to believe in it, but it's widely believed that, you know, real estate is one of the safest ways to build wealth. But who has $300,000 or $400,000 cash to go buy a house? The middle-class person doesn't have that. That middle-class person has to go to the bank and take a loan. And that loan is controlled by the Federal Reserve. So as the U.S. progressed, eventually, sure, people became wealthier over time, but the government was the one now that started to determine the conditions under which people should achieve wealth rather than leaving the market doing its work like the way it was at the time of the Gilded Age.
I'm going to link to your two volumes here at tomwoods.com/2263 and look forward to when we can get you back on. Because of course, I do want to talk about, well, I mean, again, what's the name of that period? Now I can't think of it. The Gilded Age. I couldn't get that off the tip of my tongue there. That World War I is significant because of course, the Federal Reserve is getting started right around that time. And then the Great Depression, the New Deal, there's so much still to talk about. And then of course, the various attempts to end poverty and this and that. So there are a lot of good discussion to be had, but I need to plow through that second volume. And I thought, I'll read both of them by the time you come on. This can't be done. I can't read as fast as you write, you know. So I need a couple more weeks. I'll get you back on. We'll get these juicy topics covered. But the book we've been talking about is a 2-volume study called A History of Wealth Distribution in the United States from Colonial Times to the Modern Era. Again, linked at tomwoods.com. /2263. Well, until then, Germinal, thanks so much and happy new year.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, that is another episode of the Tom Woods Show. I will see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.